This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program today, a look at the life of one of the titans of American business who was also one of our most controversial secretaries of the Treasury, Andrew W. Mellon. Historian David Cannadine is our guest. He's the author of Mellon, An American Life. The biography examines Mellon's endeavors in business, politics, art collecting, and philanthropy. The National Gallery of Art resulted from Mellon's generosity. Mellon was a young boy when the Civil War began. He was born in 1855. He lived a long life, dying in 1937 on the brink of the Second World War. Adolf Hitler was rearming Germany. David Cannadine points out early in this biography, the first published biography of Andrew Mellon, that at the time of his death, he was himself half the age of the United States, a man who played a significant role in our history. He was a Republican. He was very rich, but Cannadine says not ostentatious. He was a long-serving Secretary of the Treasury. He served Presidents Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. He was hailed as an architect of the Roaring Twenties, later to be vilified for policies leading to the Great Depression. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, historian David Cannadine, the author of many books. He was educated at Cambridge, Oxford, and Princeton. His previous books include The Decline and Fall of the British Aristocracy, now available in paperback from Vintage. He is currently teaching at the Institute of Historical Research, University of London. He is chairman of the trustees of the National Portrait Gallery of London. His new book, Mellon, An American Life, is published by Knopf. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One more note here. David Cannadine is about to begin a speaking tour of the U.S. about this book. He will be in Chicago later this month. He will speak and answer questions at the Art Institute of Chicago at noon on Saturday. Actually, I think that's Monday. I'll have to check our dates here. October 23rd, 2006. 800-222-9455, the toll-free number 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Mr. Cannadine, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Welcome to you, if I can put it in that way, from Princeton, which is where I am speaking to you from.
Oh, very good. And in Chicago, is it October 23rd? Do I have the date right?
I think it's October the 21st. That's to say a Saturday.
21st. Okay. So I had it half right and half wrong.
Well, we got the month right, and that's a good first approximation.
Okay. Very good. My apologies.
That's quite all right.
Saturday, October 21st, 2006.
Yep.
Very good. You open the story of Andrew Mellon's life in the office of President Franklin Roosevelt, the last day of 1936, not long before Andrew Mellon's death. It is an extraordinary meeting. Would you tell us why this meeting was so extraordinary?
Well, it was in a sense the perfect way to open this book, and that's nothing to do with me. It's all to do with the characters about whom I was writing. It is this astonishing encounter on New Year's Eve 1936 between Andrew Mellon, who is by then an elderly figure, by many people regarded as a figure from a reviled past of a Republican world of the 1920s, and Franklin Roosevelt, then, of course, at the zenith of his power and acclaim, having recently won re-election in November that year. And the reason they're meeting is because Mellon wants to persuade Roosevelt to accept, on behalf of the American people, this astonishing gift of Mellon's art and a huge amount of money to create a National Gallery of Art in Washington. But as if that's not enough, the irony here is that from 1934 to the summer of 1936, Mellon has been attacked and reviled and indeed prosecuted by FDR's New Deal government for what was deemed to be tax evasion on a massive scale. And as if that's not enough to make it ironic and interesting, mm-hmm. In December, earlier that month, 1936, Mellon was diagnosed with cancer. So if he was to make this gallery scheme work, he knows he hasn't got a lot of time. So it's an astonishing confrontation at a whole variety of levels, ranging from the political to the personal. And, of course, the outcome, FDR being a shrewd operator, is that Mellon basically says, here's my scheme for a great gallery in Washington, take it or leave it, and FDR takes it.
Two shrewd men in that room. Was the meeting cordial?
The meeting, I think, was very cordial, even though they were at one level sworn political enemies. I think they had a very good occasion. They drank lots of tea. There were various Roosevelt grandchildren present. It was a kind of domestic encounter. And as Mellon left, he said, what an immensely charming man FDR is. So I think it was a combination of legendary charm and astuteness on FDR's part, and if not charm on Mellon's part, since that isn't what he did, at least a sense of determination to make a great scheme work. And so here we have Mellon and FDR, these figures in many ways, generations and politically poles apart, in the end collaborating on a great scheme which has hugely benefited the American people.
Now, at the close of this preface, you say that had you been an American during the 20s and 30s, you would like to think that you had voted against Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, and then for Roosevelt. So you began this project feeling not very sympathetic to this man. That changed. How did your opinion, your understanding of Andrew Mellon change?
Well, that is a good question, and I kind of dangled this sense of what my, I have to say, rather feeble political commitments are in the introduction so that people should know where I was coming from. I certainly do share the view that when FDR took over in America in effectively the spring of 1933, he inherited, as it were, a country where the economy and the banking system were on the brink of collapse. There was no social security, there were no pensions, banking wasn't regulated, there were no trade unions' rights. He inherited, in a sense, the world of which Andrew Mellon was a child, a creator, an architect, a beneficiary, and in some senses an ornament, but a world that was then beginning to pass away. And so it was a rather interesting challenge as a historian to try to write about a figure to whom, in some ways, I was politically not very sympathetic. But, you know, one of the great challenges of being a historian is to try to write about people to whom you wouldn't necessarily feel especially warm, but who were nevertheless major and significant figures. And beyond any question, Mellon was a hugely significant and major figure in the history of America throughout the whole of his long and big and varied and immensely significant and also very controversial life. And to have the chance to write about someone like that was an opportunity I couldn't possibly resist.
Now, why had his life until now not been chronicled?
That of itself is a very extraordinary story. I mean, there's a kind of history of why there has been no Mellon biography. Andrew Mellon died in 1937, and at his death, his son, Paul Mellon, and his daughter, Ailsa Mellon Bruce, did think that there ought to be a biography of their father, and they commissioned a writer called Burton Hendrick, who had written A Life of Andrew Carnegie and various other things. He was a Pulitzer Prize winner. He was a substantial figure. To write the life of their father. And he duly wrote it. And the terms on which he wrote it were that Ailsa and Paul would pay him a salary, but that they would have the right of veto if they didn't in the end decide they wanted the book published. And in the end, that was the decision they took, although the book was not very controversial and was, although appreciative and in some ways incisive, in general rather bland in its tone. They concluded that they didn't want the book published. We're now in 1940, as it were. The world has moved on from Andrew Mellon's world. We're on the brink of Pearl Harbor. FDR is in charge. The generations have moved on. And I think that Paul and Ailsa decided that Andrew had come and gone. His estate had been settled. The tax trial had been settled. The gallery was open in Washington. Things were moving on, and it was just all best left. But the result of that was that for the next 30, 40, 50 years, no biography of Andrew was written because this unpublished biography had been written and nothing else had happened. And so in an odd way, Mellon was the great absence from that group of figures, Frick, Carnegie, Rockefeller, Ford, the great robber baron generation. All of them have had their lives written more than once. Mellon was their exact contemporary. But he sort of wasn't there because his life wasn't written. And so he's a kind of absent figure from American history in a way that I think is not appropriate, although for the reasons I've just given, it's easy to see why.
Now, here are some words you use to describe Mellon in the book's preface. Shy, sad, silent, secretive, self-sufficient, and self-enclosed. How was he able to succeed so in business and go on to public service?
Well, as your quotation suggests, I fear I rather overdid the alliteration there, but nevertheless, it's all kind of true. I think it's an interesting issue to think about, not just in Mellon's time, but as is the case in many aspects of Mellon's life, that these issues still resonate in our world today, of what it takes to be very good at making money, and whether those are, as it were, transferable skills. And I think that one of the things that's interesting about Mellon is that he was this complicated and in many ways rather fenced-in personality. But despite that, or perhaps in some ways because of that, he's an absolute genius at making money. But I don't think those skills transferred. That's to say that when it comes to human relations, he really isn't very good. When it comes to politics, he's an amazingly important and forceful Secretary of the Treasury, but he's not politically very adroit. So that it's rather, I suppose, like being good at tennis or something. It doesn't automatically follow that because you're good at one particular thing, which Mellon certainly was, that it necessarily means you'll be good at anything else. And in particular, I think it is clear that while Mellon's judgment in business of men and possibilities, and they are, of course, all men in those days, was unerring, when it comes to an emotional life, Mellon's judgment of women and love is kind of hopeless.
Yeah. Did he see the flaw?
I don't think he really did, no. I think that he wasn't much given to introspection. I don't think he thought much about himself in those sort of ways. And while, of course, he never ceased to regret the fact that his marriage had been a disaster, I don't think he lost a lot of sleep over that. I don't think he spent much time on that at all.
How did he feel about his children?
He was very devoted to them. And his diaries for the 1900s and 1910s, which is when the children are growing up, Ailill Mellon, Bruce, she was born in 1900, Paul Mellon was born in 1907. Mellon was devoted to his children, and after the divorce from his wife in 1912, he's in a sense a hands-on single parent, though that's not the way it was thought about in those days. And he worked and tried very hard to be a devoted and committed and hands-on father. He bought them lots of presents. He spent lots of time with them. He took enormous joy in their developing lives. But what is interesting is that while that's the view of things from his perspective, the view of things from the children's perspective was very different. They found their father cold, intimidating, standoffish, and very distant. And they thought he was not a success as a father, even though he tried rather hard, according to his own lights, to be so.
Hmm. He fell head over heels in love when he was in his 40s with a young woman of 19, Nora McMullen. I wonder, you know, was his marriage an attempt to join the living, if I could put it that way?
Well, it's a very well-put question. It is this extraordinary story that in 1900, Mellon is 45. He's at the peak of his power and innovativeness and brilliance as a financier, as a banker, as an industrialist. It's just in that period that he concludes a set of deals which project him from being a merely rich plutocrat Pittsburgh figure to being a hugely rich major American player in the prosperity of the country at that time. And at exactly that time, he falls in love, as you say, with this woman, Nora McMullen. They're introduced on a transatlantic liner by Henry Clay Frick, a great friend and contemporary of Mellon's. And it's a story, in a way, straight out of Edith Wharton or Henry James, who, of course, wrote exactly about this world of Europeans and Americans interconnecting, not always happily at that time. Andrew is 45, Nora is 19. Andrew has had a couple of previous liaisons with women which haven't worked out, and then he's been devoted to business. He meets this woman who, in the parlance of the time, was a healthy English country girl who liked fox hunting and country life in England. He becomes immediately and rather uncharacteristically, I think, smitten with her. She thinks this is probably not a good idea because of the age difference, because of their difference in interests. But he prevails in the end, and they duly marry in the summer of 1900, and he brings her to Pittsburgh. And they steam into Pittsburgh, having, of course, come across the Atlantic on the boat. And there Nora beholds this astonishing environment of Pittsburgh, soot, smoke, fog, pollution, filth. And they get off the train, and Nora says to him in dismay, "You don't mean to say we live here?" Mm. And the answer, of course, was yes, they did, and she loathed it.
And at this point, he was not yet a rich man, correct?
Well, he was a rich man. He was already worth several million dollars
in
1900. But remembering Rockefeller's observation about J.P. Morgan made about 15 years later, and to think he wasn't really a wealthy man, and J.P. Morgan was worth $80 million, I mean, it's all relative.
Yeah.
He wasn't rich in 1900 on a Morgan, let alone a Rockefeller scale of values. Mellon comes late to enormous riches. But by 1910, he's worth $20 or $30 million, which in our own currency would be a lot of money. Yeah. But he does come quite late to money in a big way, just as he comes late to marriage. And on the whole, he does rather better at money than he does at marriage.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian David Cannadine. We're talking with him about his biography of Andrew Mellon, Mellon, An American Life. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions or comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question, if I may go a bit far afield. I noticed in your introduction you mentioned that the gentleman had written a book on the decline and fall of the British aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yes, it is correct.
Okay.
Yep.
My question, and it's a very far afield, is have you ever come across a writer by the name of Nesta Webster, who is a British writer, unfortunately an anti-Semite, and she's written a number of books that were very popular, in Britain in the 20s and 30s, and apparently moved in aristocratic circles, and she ended up being quoted, let's see if I can find it here, in an article by Winston Churchill called Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People, which was in the Illustrated Sunday Herald in London on February 8th, 1920, And it seemed like, well, it didn't seem like it was in that article that Mr. Churchill seemed to accept her point of view at that particular time. But she seems to be part of the aristocratic classes, or however, written at the time. There's very little written about her, so that's my question. Okay.
Okay, a little far afield, but let's see what Mr. Cannadine can do.
Well, a variety of answers to this, I suppose. One is I haven't heard of this person or read her work, so I can't help you there. It's certainly true more broadly that if one looks, as I did, at the history of the British aristocracy in the 1920s and 30s, then certainly in certain quarters of the of those people, there is a considerable degree of anti-Semitism. But it's also fair to say, in the case of Winston Churchill himself, that that really wasn't true. Churchill had many Jewish friends, among them the Rothschild banking family. He was actually quite strongly pro-Zionist. And so I don't think he would necessarily figure in that. I ought to say more broadly that one of the ways in which I got from, as it were, the decline of the British aristocracy to the life of Andrew Mellon is that, of course, one of the ways in which one can track the aristocracy's decline in Britain from the 1880s and with growing intensity in the 1920s and 30s is that they're selling off pictures, their family pictures very often, in order to raise money. And, of course, one of the people who is buying those pictures, especially during the 1920s and 30s, is Andrew Mellon.
Very interesting. What kind of an eye did he have, Mellon?
Mellon's sense of art, I think, like many of these very rich Americans, I mean, Frick or Isabella Stewart Gardner or Havemeyer or J.P. Morgan, it's very difficult to get a sense of how truly they were touched and moved by art. I think part of Mellon was, though his nature was so inscrutable that it's very difficult to check that out. But also for Mellon, as I suspect for many other of these people, one of the things that really turns them on is they love the dealing. Mellon buys mainly through Juveen and Knoedlers, and one of the things he really loves is that they produce pictures for certain prices, and he loves getting them for less than they want. And so it's the pleasure of the chase, in part, which is what turns Mellon on about pictures. Although I think also, up to a point at least, he was genuinely moved by art, and certainly late in his life, when he conceives this scheme of the National Gallery of Art in Washington, that he wants his pictures to be the originating collection for, he becomes very excited by that as another of these great schemes that he has to make the world a different place, as had been true for him earlier in business, and as by the 1930s is true for him in pictures.
Yeah. I want to take another call here momentarily, but one more question here. Can one fairly compare Mellon with the business titans and philanthropists of our day, say Warren Buffett and Bill Gates?
Well, I think that there is. There are all sorts of ways in which Mellon's life resonates with our own time, one of which is, what do you do with huge amounts of money? If you make it, you can't take it with you, so what do you do? Another one is that Mellon was a Republican, and how far does what he think or does what he did resonate with the current administration in Washington? So I think in all sorts of ways, in fact, the issues that Mellon's life raises and exemplifies are still with us. And one of them, certainly, as you say in your question, is how does Mellon as a philanthropist square with the kind of philanthropy that's going on now? I think it is interesting that in Mellon's time, one of the ways in which you would think about the best way to benefit the American people would be to create an art gallery, following, in some senses, the precedence of Frick and Huntington and Isabella Stewart Gardner. Whereas nowadays, if we're talking Warren Buffett or Bill Gates, and you think of how can you best use your money to the public benefit, it's more likely to be education or AIDS. And I think that there is a sense in which notions of how to put money to good philanthropic use do alter over time. But what I think doesn't alter is that very rich people do begin to get a sense as they get older that they've got to give serious, creative, imaginative thought to what to do with their money.
Hmm. Let's take another call now. Listener in Champaign on line 2. Hello.
Hello. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, and my father was the Internal Revenue agent who did, I guess, a great deal of the work on Andrew Mellon's taxes. And I remember as a child, probably about the fourth grade, it would be 1934, my father had to attend court for the trial, and he suggested to my mother that we come along and watch. And it was very interesting. In the courthouse, we were, my mother and my sister and I, were in the elevator with Andrew Mellon and his attorney. That was all. And it was so exciting for us to be that close to him. And I remember in the trial just a great deal of pity for him because he was very, very old. And all he did was sit there, and they would tell him the charges and ask him about it, and he would always answer, "I don't recall." And that was my memory.
Well,
Of course, a great moment, and wonderful that you were there. The tax trial is, of course, an extraordinary story, as your observations suggest. Mellon comes back to America in the spring of 1933, when FDR, of course, has just taken over. And from 1934, as you say, in Pittsburgh to 1936, he's pursued pretty relentlessly by FDR's New Deal administration for what they insist is tax evasion. FDR did a lot of this. There are many high-profile tax trials of rich Republicans during the early years of FDR's administration, and Mellon was, in a sense, the most highly profiled, very rich, a Republican all his life, Secretary of the Treasury from 21 to 32, an obvious target in a world in which, in the 1930s, bankers, rich people, praised in the 20s, have become reviled as the people who stood by and watched the slump and the depression happen. The irony is that while there were many things to be said against Mellon in the 1920s, the one thing that Mellon was actually very careful and scrupulous about was that he did pay his taxes. He did believe that rich men ought to pay taxes, and he paid a huge amount of money in taxes in the 1920s. And so, in a way, it was an ill-judged ploy on Roosevelt's part to go for Mellon for tax evasion. The Treasury, in 1933 to 4, say and tell the Attorney General's office, there is no case that we can make. And it's the Attorney General's office that insist on prosecuting Mellon, egged on by FDR. But there really was no case. And in the end, of course, after he dies, in December 1937, Mellon was actually acquitted.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Listener, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
What was your father's opinion of the case as he was with the IRS?
He was really very he was really very sad for Mellon. Hmm. I think he liked him a lot. And, you know, he was working on the figures, and he produced what he had, but I think he was pro-Mellon.
Interesting.
It's an interesting story, this. I mean, one of the things that, of course, becomes commonplace in America in the 1930s, well, not commonplace, but it nevertheless happens, is that you prosecute people for tax evasion if you can't prosecute them for anything else, even though you believe that they may have done other bad things. And the classic instance of this, of course, is Al Capone, who is thought to have murdered, as it were, half of Chicago, but they can't produce evidence for that. So they prosecute him for tax evasion, and of course they get him for tax evasion. The irony in Mellon's case is that there were, I think, various rules and laws in the 1920s as Secretary of the Treasury that he had broken. And so you can see why the Democratic administration does go for him for tax evasion. But the problem in Mellon's case was that the one thing he scrupulously did was that he paid his taxes.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing story.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody could have made this up.
Yeah. Very interesting. He was asked to become Secretary of the Treasury in 1921. What was his tenure? What were the hallmarks of his tenure there at Treasury for that long period, 11 years?
As you say, Mellon is Secretary from 1921 to 1932, and it's said of him that three presidents served under him, as you mentioned, Harding, Coolidge, and then Hoover. When he becomes Secretary of the Treasury, he's 65, so as it were, in for most people, this would be a retirement job. Most people haven't heard of him. He's a very rich Pittsburgh banker and industrialist, but he's, on the whole, kept his name out of the papers. And he gets the job because Pennsylvania's two senators, Philander Knox and Boyce Penrose, tell Harding, who doesn't really know much about this, that Mellon would be very good, that there ought to be a practical businessman as Secretary of the Treasury rather than an academic economist. And so Mellon gets the job. The first part of his tenure of office is immensely successful from 1921 to 29. The good times roll. This is the jazz age. It's the roaring 20s. It's Scott Fitzgerald's world. America booms. And that's the time when Mellon gets the nickname, the greatest Secretary of the Treasury since Alexander Hamilton. And to some degree, he deserved the credit for that, though not as much as I think as some people thought. But then, of course, from 29 to 32, it all goes wrong. The Wall Street crash, this catastrophic economic cyclone which hits America and Western Europe and leads people to believe between 1929 and 32 that the whole capitalist system may be in terminal tailspin and collapse. And Mellon just, as it were, stands and sits by and says, this is all very shocking, but it will just correct itself in the fullness of time. We can't do anything. And so Mellon, having been praised greatly, perhaps excessively, as the architect of the prosperity of the 20s, then becomes completely reviled, second only to Herbert Hoover, from 1929 to 32, as the man on whose watch, as Secretary of the Treasury, the Depression occurred, and the man who didn't do much about it.
Yeah. How did he weather these years that were so difficult, beginning with the crash and then running through the trial?
I think Mellon was a fairly stoical man. He never thought much of public acclaim, and therefore he was, up to a point, willing to take public derision and scorn on the chin. But I don't think there is any doubt that there was a bigger issue than that. That is to say that Mellon had lived until 1932 kind of with the grain of American history, if I can put it that way. Big business, Republican dominance, limited government, making America a place where business could flourish. That was Mellon's world. He was a child of that world and in some ways an ornament of that world. And what's interesting to see is that from 32, 33 on, when FDR comes in with a New Deal, all that is overturned. The belief that businessmen are heroic figures goes. FDR attacks them unrelentingly. The belief that government shouldn't intervene goes. FDR says, we're going to fix this and the government will fix it. The dominance of the Republican Party in Pennsylvania and in Pittsburgh simply goes. So all the presuppositions, in a sense, not just of Mellon's youth, but of his whole life, are simply overturned in the last 5 or 6 years of his life. For good or ill, America enters a new world. And what's remarkable about Mellon is that notwithstanding all of that, he becomes one of the great bogeymen as a result. He is nevertheless determined to go ahead with this great scheme that he invented in the late 1920s to create a national gallery in Washington for the benefit of the American people, even though by the early 1930s, the American people really have no time for him at all.
Mm. Also, I think it's worth noting that through his life up until this point, he and his family, as the rest of the country, had to weather other downturns, panics and depressions. And I don't know if the government did much of anything in those difficulties.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, Mellon was brought up and practiced brilliantly as a businessman during the period from effectively when he became an adult, the 1870s to the 1920s, where ups and downs in the business cycle were just the way it was. And for Mellon, you prospered in prosperous times by expanding, and you prospered in bad times because you kept going and you could buy up rivals who were not so able to survive as you were. And for Mellon, that was what life was all about. And being able to survive bad times was as much an essential part of being a good businessman as being able to benefit in good times. And that was the world that Mellon grew up in, a kind of 19th century laissez-faire view of capitalism and the economy. And for him, therefore, 1929 to 33 is just the latest iteration of the world he's always lived in. Mm. But what Mellon, I think, couldn't understand was that by 1929 to 33, it was no longer sustainable simply to say how shocking, but we'll get over it. That by then, unlike the world he'd grown up in, America was a mass urban democracy. The scale of destitution and devastation from 1929 to 33 was like nothing that had ever happened before. Capitalism is seriously at risk. We have communism in Russia. We have fascism about to take over in Germany. The notion that you could simply stand idly by and say, we'll get through it, just wasn't good enough anymore. And I think Mellon, you know, he's in his mid-70s by then anyway. Most people are fairly set in their age by then. Mellon simply couldn't grasp that.
He was very much also a child of his father. Tell us about the judge.
Well, the greatest figure in the Mellon family in many ways is not Andrew Mellon, though he was an astonishing figure and is the most significant Mellon in terms of the historical record. But in terms of the man who makes it all possible and gets it started, and in terms of the man in some ways who is the most extraordinary character, then it's Andrew Mellon's father, Thomas Mellon, known as Judge Mellon because he was for a time a judge in Pittsburgh. Thomas was born in Northern Ireland. The Mellons were Scots-Irish Presbyterian in the 1810s and migrate with his parents to western Pennsylvania in the late 1810s. The Mellons in those days were farmers. Thomas decides this is not the life that he would regard as fulfilling. And Thomas is the great self-made figure in the Mellon story, gets himself a degree at what later became the University of Pittsburgh, qualifies as a lawyer, is a very successful lawyer, and then through being a lawyer gets involved in real estate, in coal, in business in a whole variety of ways. Also is astonishingly well-read in philosophy, in sociology, in literature. A very remarkable man, but also incredibly self-willed and determined and embattled. For him, the great purpose of life was what he called acquisition and accumulation. And like all Mellons, I think, of that time, he wasn't a man to make a party go. But he insisted and forced on his children, above all Andrew, that their job in life was to make money. And Andrew was not the eldest son, but he was the favorite son and the most talented son. And Andrew inherits, I think, from his father this sense of stern self-mastery, this determination to succeed, this astonishing business flair. And Andrew always said that when confronted with a major business problem, the first question he would ask himself is, what would my father have done?
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting that you can combine this personality who is shy, sad, silent, with such ambition and aggressiveness.
He was a very remarkable combination of characteristics, and I think the shyness, the silence, the self-effacingness should not be confused with a lack of self-confidence. I think that, on the contrary, Andrew knew he was a man of enormous talent, which I think, within limits, he was. He was a man of enormous ambition, and in some ways he was a man of enormous aggressiveness, though I think he hid that well. But he was turned on and excited by business deals, by the possibility of helping bright young men create new and exciting companies like Gulf or Alcoa or Carborundum or Coppers, which were among the many great iconic Mellon companies. And I remember Andrew's son Paul Mellon saying to me on one occasion that although they didn't have much in common, he remembered his father being excited by business in a way that he, Paul, was excited by his racehorses winning a race.
Mm-hmm.
And that sense of being excited by business, even though he was a shy, turned in on himself man, I think tells one a lot about Mellon. I think that's how he got fulfillment and a sense of personal adventure. Business was the route to that.
What happened to the empire?
The business empire? Well, the business empire is, of course, an extraordinary story. Andrew Mellon inherits, or is given by his father, Thomas Mellon and Sons, the family bank, which the judge, the patriarch, the great founder of the family, establishes in 1869 to 70, in part to give some of his sons something to do. And he recognizes in Andrew a particular and unique talent among all the brothers, that's to say, among all his children. And Andrew, in a sense, takes over this small-scale nickel-and-dime family bank and converts it into the great economic instrument for the transformation of western Pennsylvania in the late 19th century. Pittsburgh is one of these boom miracle towns from the 1880s to the 1910s. Steel, coal, a whole variety of other new industries need financing. And Andrew is the man who puts up the money for that. And so it's Andrew who really helps create, as I've already said, Alcoa, Coppers, Carborundum, Gulf, this astonishing range of iconic American companies. And he puts money in. He sponsors clever young men to make these companies work. He gets shares in the companies in exchange for that and becomes very prosperous as the companies prosper. And so Mellon has this astonishingly broadly based industrial portfolio of old industries, coal and steel, and of new industries, electricity, petrochemicals. And none of them bear the Mellon name. So it's a huge fortune, diversely invested, but also lowly profiled. And that's what Mellon creates. And that world lasts through Mellon's life to the 1930s. I mean, since then, of course, the companies have gone their separate ways. They've been acquired by other businesses. But Mellon really was an amazingly accomplished and talented and innovative and creative businessman. And he thought that this was good for the country, that if you created great businesses which prospered, you would employ more people, trickle-down economics would occur, everybody would be better off. What was good for American business was good for America. And Mellon passionately believed that.
So we can add pragmatist to the list of adjectives.
We can certainly add that. And I think, again, we are back to the point I made earlier, that these are issues that still resonate, that this sense that what is good for American business is good for America would, of course, be a view that you could probably find fairly widespread in Washington today.
Yeah. What would you like to say about how Mellon combined and used his relationships in his personal life, his political life, and his business life?
I think relationships and Mellon is one of these very complicated subjects, as I think is often true with rich men. I mean, we now live in a world where women are beginning to become rich in their own right, but in Mellon's time, they were mainly rich men. I think Mellon was very good at business relationships. He produces a whole set of protégés and friends who create these great companies that I've already mentioned with his support. And his business relationships were very good. And when he goes to Washington in the 1920s, there's a whole new generation of people like Parker Gilbert and David Finley and Donald Shepard and David Bruce, his son-in-law, who help him as a Secretary of the Treasury and who help him get the National Gallery going. And again, I think those relationships, which were in some senses business and professionally based, were as close as Mellon ever got to close relations. The relations that he was very difficult at were with his wife, Nora, whom he divorces in 1912, and with his children, Paul Mellon and Ailsa Mellon. And I think he was very inhibited, very shy, very undemonstrative. And certainly the children felt deprived emotionally, having had him as a father. So it's a rather interesting story of enormous success in terms of professional and business relationships, but of a lack of success in terms of personal relationships. And in that, of course, Mellon was not unusual. I mean, then and indeed across to now, it's often the case, I think, that in very rich families, the professional relationships are quite good, but the personal relationships are often very vexed.
Hmm. What was his introduction to politics?
The introduction to politics is that Mellon is a child of late 19th century Pennsylvania, a state dominated both statewide and in Pittsburgh more precisely by the Republicans. It was famously said that the state legislature of Pennsylvania was the best state legislature that money could buy. And the money that bought it was Mellon, I think, to some degree, and Carnegie and Frick and the Pennsylvania Railroad Company. And that was the world that Mellon grew up in and the world that Mellon accepted as the best of all possible worlds, dominated by Republicans who believed that the purpose of politics was to make the world better for businessmen like himself, who would then create companies and make America more prosperous. Mm. And Mellon funds the Republican Party very generously. And that's his connection. And it's because of that connection that he becomes, by the 1900s, a major figure in the Republican Party, not as a political activist, but as a very resourceful and generous donor. And, as it were, the segue from that to becoming Secretary of the Treasury, in the end, turns out to be very easy. Mm. But that was Mellon's world. And, again, it's a world that Roosevelt completely overturns in the 1930s.
Yeah. And here again we have another part of this story where we see a resonance with the issues of the day, of our day.
I think that the issues that Mellon raises and exemplified, for good or ill in his own life, are issues that are very much with us still. What is the relationship between big business and government? Is it good for government to have business people in it? Is it the purpose of government to make the world better for business? Because if business prospers, everybody else will prosper. That's one set of issues that are still very much with us. Another set of issues which are still very much with us are, is it the purpose of government to balance the budget, which Mellon passionately believed? Is it the purpose of business to reduce the national debt, which Mellon passionately believed? So if, as it were, we wanted to run a kind of Andrew Mellon audit of the present government in Washington, another Republican government, which has some members who would certainly claim Mellon as a kind of ancestral figure, I think we'd probably reach a sort of 50-50 conclusion, really. I think the boxes that the present administration for Mellon would tick would be business people in government, a government concerned to further a business agenda. But what it wouldn't tick would be running a surplus, not a deficit, and getting the national debt under control. So Mellon, I think, has a very equivocal relation with the present Republican government, and that's interesting both in terms of the government and in terms of Mellon.
Hmm. What were his thoughts about something like public education or public health?
I don't think Mellon had much thoughts about either of those. Hmm. I mean, he comes from Pittsburgh, and of course in the late 19th and early 20th century, Pittsburgh is an incredibly degraded environment. It's known as hell with a lid taken off. It's this world where the steel mills run 24 hours a day. It's astonishingly polluted. The atmosphere is amazingly polluted. The rivers are polluted. The environment is in every way degraded. The standard of living of ordinary workers was terribly low. I don't think Mellon thought much about that. In terms of education, Mellon did become interested in that. He was a great benefactor to the University of Pittsburgh. And, of course, Paul Mellon goes to Yale, and he was certainly rather proud of the fact that his son was a well-educated figure. So in those things, as in others, Mellon's position was quite equivocal in some ways. But I don't think he ever thought that it was the job of the state to do any of this. I think his view was very strongly that these were things that private enterprise ought to do.
Yeah.
He really did inherit his father's opinion that people should make their own lives, and the state should not provide a safety net of support. Now, of course, if you were as rich as Mellon, it was easy to say that. And I think he didn't have a great deal of sympathy for ordinary people, though it is fair to say that in 1929 to 32, he and his brother Dick did put in quite a lot of money in Pittsburgh into public welfare programs, even though he didn't really approve of them.
Yeah. It's almost a story right out of Dickens, isn't it?
It is a remarkable story. I mean, there is a sense in which he is a Dickensian figure, born, of course, 1855. I mean, this is Dickens' time. And he is a 19th-century figure. There is this sense that it's a free market economy, that every person is in charge of their own life, that you make your own fortune or you fail to, that the state is a very minimalist world which should impinge upon your life as little as possible. That really was the world that Mellon grew up in. But, of course, by the 1920s and 30s, that's becoming a decreasingly possible position to maintain. I mean, to say in 1932, you know, we've just got to weather the storm isn't good enough when hundreds of millions or hundreds of thousands of people are out of jobs, their savings have been wiped out, they're living in kind of cardboard cupboards called Hoovervilles outside cities. It just wasn't good enough. I mean, FDR may not in the end have alleviated the whole of the recession, but he did undertake to say and to do that the federal government had to do something. It couldn't just say, this is awful. And I think Mellon, in a sense, never really understood why FDR did that or why it was important that he should be seen to try.
Mm. He never came around like Mr. Gradgrind of Dickens.
I think that Mellon never really believed that it was the purpose of the federal government to interfere, as he would have seen it, in the lives of ordinary people. And, of course, once FDR goes for him over the tax trial, Mellon takes a very dim view of Roosevelt. Though, of course, it is rather interesting that in the end, it was a disagreement over means, not ends. I mean, FDR wants to save American society. He wants to save the American economy. And in that sense, he was on the same side as Mellon. The difference was that Mellon thought, in the end, it would all sort itself, whereas Roosevelt's view was, we can't wait for that to happen. We've got to do something now, and the federal government's got to do something now. And that, for Mellon, was anathema.
Hmm. We have to wrap up here. Any final thought you'd like to leave us with?
Well, I think the only final thought is that, you know, Mellon was a flawed, interesting, extraordinarily complicated man. It's a huge and big life which impacts on lots of different ways on the history of America from the 1850s to the 1930s. I can't say that having lived with this man for 12 years, as I have as his biographer, I fully understand what made him tick. But he was an amazing figure. It was an amazing life. It's worth knowing about for its own sake, and it's also worth knowing about because I think many of the issues that his life touched and raised and connected with are still with us today.
Fascinating story and a very good read. David Cannadine, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
You're very welcome. Historian David Cannadine has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His new book, Mellon and American Life, is published by Knopf. One more note, David Cannadine is about to begin a speaking tour about this book, and he will be in Chicago later this month. He will speak and answer questions at the Art Institute of Chicago at noon on Saturday, October 21st, 2006.